Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is June 2nd, so happy June. And for all of us normal people out there, this is a regular month of summer. If you are, live in the United States and you see a lot of these companies that are unfortunately pushing out all of the Pride merch, then this is the beginning of a very long month of having an insane agenda just forced down our throats. But I think that it's become a little less as companies are recognizing that woke doesn't in fact work. But more on that in a little bit. First, we want to cover the targeted terror attack in Colorado. This is multiple injuries in Boulder on Pearl Street. For those of you who know my background, I'm from Boulder, Colorado originally, and you know, I've been to Pearl Street many, many times. This is a horrible headline to see from last night, and this coming from the Washington Examiner. FBI Director Kash Patel said his department is investigating a targeted terror attack in Boulder, Colorado, after a suspect reportedly attacked people who were participating in a walk to remember the Israeli hostages still in Gaza. Patel posted this on X, quote, we are aware of and fully investigating a targeted terror attack in Boulder, Colorado. Our agents and local law enforcement are on the scene already, and we will share updates as more information becomes available. And Todd Starnes at toddstarnes.com, of course, is bringing live coverage of the firebomb terrorist attack. And several people on social media have also recognized this, that and this coming from Election Wizard, one of the accounts that I follow on X. Just so we're clear, over 2 months, pro-Palestinian extremists torched Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro's mansion with his family inside, murdered two Israeli embassy staffers in D.C., and firebombed a Colorado vigil for Israeli hostages. So let's go to Todd Starnes now. And Todd, I think that this increasing wave of anti-Semitic terror on U.S. soil is indicating something more broadly, especially now that we are learning reportedly the perpetrator in Colorado was not even in the United States legally.
Right. That information coming from Fox News, Bill Malugin, quoting at least three separate government sources. This guy, Mohammed Salmani, was actually in the country illegally. He had been granted a visa, a temporary visa, during the Biden administration and overstayed that visa. So he is, in fact, in the country illegally. But again, I think the broader issue here is the fact there is a very, very dangerous there's a dangerous plot in this country. And unfortunately, the Biden administration thought it was a good idea to bring in these very dangerous people into the United States. And it really does put every Christian, certainly every Jew, in the crosshairs of these Islamic radicals that have been allowed into the country. And there are grave concerns that there might possibly be other attacks, other sleeper cells out there. This is something that a number of members of Congress have told me over the years, that it's just not a matter of if, but when these sleeper cells are activated.
And so with the FBI now in the hands of Kash Patel and Dan Bongino, that's at least, I think, encouraging. We also have the Supreme Court now allowing Trump to move forward with around 500,000 deportations. Do you think that we're going to see some solution to this before even more terror occurs across the United States?
I think that's unlikely. And again, I think you have to look at the, you have to really drill down on the numbers. And I think the interesting thing here is that former President Bill Clinton was actually the most pro-deportation president we've ever had. Over 14 million illegals were deported during his 8 years in office. So the administration's been out over the past couple of days boasting about this figure, a little over 3,000 a day or whatever, something of that nature. If you do the math, that's only about a little over a million illegals a year that would end up being deported. So that number certainly sounds impressive, but in reality, it's not. I mean, we've got, by the administration's own numbers, somewhere north of 20 million illegals living in the country right now. So we really have been invaded. And, you know, a big challenge has been the activist courts that are stepping in and they're trying to prevent President Trump from doing this. So, again, I think it's all good news, you know, the 500,000, but it's really just a drop in the bucket when you look at the nature and the significance of the invasion of these illegals.
Yeah, I'm speaking with Todd Starnes, who is a radio host and an author, and his book is The Star-Spangled Blessings. This is a new book, and also Twilight's Last Gleaming. There are quite a few books, actually, by Todd Starnes, and you can find all of those on Amazon, wherever books are sold. And Todd, I'm also looking at the Democrats' response to the Boulder, Colorado attack, and it seems to be not only that Democrats have a messaging problem, clearly, but now when something like this happens, they're condemning anti-Semitism, of course, you know, condemning the violence and all of this, but they have pro-Palestinians in their own party in Congress, and they refuse to condemn statements made by, for example, Ilhan Omar. They refuse to condemn some of these things coming from their own party. And so I find this to be a major, major conflict. And very hypocritical to see Democrats like, you know, Hakeem Jeffries posting, you know, this statement as the House minority leader. And yet they're posting this with a straight face, not really either not willing to recognize the hypocrisy or just brazenly doing it anyway.
Well, this morning and some of the national coverage, words like anti-Semitism aren't even being uttered. MSNBC yesterday was identifying the perpetrator of all of this as a white guy, when it was very clear you actually had video. This was clearly a Middle Eastern man, and of course we now know that he is an Egyptian national, came to this country. So again, they're going to go out of their way to try and downplay this. But I think ultimately when you look at what's happening in our, you know, on our university campuses across the country, where this sort of anti-Semitism has been allowed to fester, and in many cases, and especially in the Ivy League schools, where anti-Semitism has, this has become an incubator for that sort of rhetoric. And it's a very dangerous time in America. Again, the radical Islamists are after the Christians and the Jews, and it is something that everybody must pay very close attention to. You know, the tragedy, Jenna, I was looking at some of the video of the immediate aftermath, and there was one woman, and you could hear her say, "If only I had had my gun." And I tell you, Boulder County has the strictest gun laws in the entire state of Colorado. And the reality is, and a lot of people are asking about this, but the reality is nobody was allowed to basically have a gun there. So, you know, that's what happened. So it's a very, very sad thing that happened in Boulder. Just a great tragedy.
It is. And you're right. I mean, Boulder has some of the strictest gun laws. And of course, you know, with the full Democrat control there, there is a huge push to be very anti Second Amendment in not only the legislature, but coming from the governor's office there. And Colorado has an opportunity because their governor, Jared Polis, is term limited to make some better choices in terms of their leadership in November of next year. And we will hope for that. But one other thing you mentioned, Todd Starnes, is about how Islam is fundamentally in conflict with with Christianity and Judaism. And I think that this is a larger storm that is brewing in the West. And we're seeing, you know, some of this clash between the ideologies that are simply incompatible and incompatible with freedom and liberty. And so when it comes to President Trump being very America first, which actually does mean being very pro-Israel, some of this ideological clash that has been kind of an undercurrent is now rearing its ugly head because of some of these ideological differences. So where are we heading with a lot of this? Because there are just so many issues intertwined. I mean, this isn't just about Western ideology. This isn't just about immigration policy. This isn't just about leftism. This isn't just about anti-Semitism. I mean, all of this is kind of coming together in what we're seeing on full display now.
Well, I think we're coming to a point where I think people are beginning to understand, and unfortunately, I think this may be a little too late. Where people are beginning to understand that the basic values of Islam are not compatible with Western civilization, and it's just simply not going to work. And we've seen this happening, and we're watching this unfold right now across Western Europe, where over the weekend France was just devastated by these massive violent riots. You had the Islamists out there, and a lot of these people were brought into the country. I mean, it's unfettered immigration. We've seen it happen across Western Europe, and unfortunately, you know, we have people in this country, and let me say this, even some Republicans who believe that we should have unfettered immigration and we should be allowing some very dangerous people into this country. This is about conquering nations. And that's what's happening in Western Europe. And if we are not careful, if we are not very careful, we will see that happening here in the streets of America. And what happened in Boulder will be a daily occurrence in this country.
And that's incredibly scary to think about, because nothing like this should ever happen anywhere, but especially in the United States. And as we're seeing, you know, this continue to rise, what do you think, Todd Starnes, should be the Trump administration's next move then? I mean, we have the Supreme Court opinion. We have, obviously, the known individuals that can and should be immediately deported. But there is a lot of talk, even among conservatives and Republicans, that some measure of due process should be afforded even people who have clearly entered this country illegally. They've overstayed their visas. I mean, they're subject to deportation, but, you know, but they should get at least a hearing. We need to make sure that we're not, you know, deporting someone who isn't actually within that category. And we're seeing that even some Republicans have some hesitation over the kind of mass deportation that the Trump administration is currently at least saying that they're strategizing for.
Well, I think there are some other measures that we could take. And again, it's, do we have the fortitude to do this? I would immediately, the first thing this morning, I would have put out a statement immediately defunding every public university that has had a history of promoting anti-Semitism. Doesn't matter if they're a state-sponsored school, Ivy League school, if they're getting federal tax dollars, we should yank every single one of those dollars, and we should just lay down the law here. That's one of the first things I would do. And then I would immediately commence with the roundup. The Supreme Court giving the White House a big victory over the weekend and their ability to do that with the 500,000. But I would start making good on this, and we have got to make sure that we're only bringing in the best and the brightest and not people that want to blow us up or firebomb us.
Well said. And Todd Starnes continues to have live coverage of this and many other headlines that you need to know. And you can find that at toddstarnes.com. You can also follow him on X at Todd Starnes. And we as Christians, Todd, need to be daily in the Word, understanding not just our Christian faith, but then for Sunday morning and our Christian life at home, but how this affects policy, how this affects our worldview from a biblical perspective. And you have a brand new book that is out for pre-order now that is called Star Spangled Blessings, Devotions for Patriots. I mean, pre-order your copy now at toddstarnes.com. This sounds like a great book, and give us a little bit of a preview.
Well, it's a super fun book, already a bestseller on Amazon, and the book will officially be in bookstores around the country in about 2 weeks, but you can get a copy right now at toddstearns.com, and it's a wonderful collection of stories detailing how God has blessed America and some little-known stories about how God has used some of our presidents to advance his kingdom work. So it's a lot of fun. And we really hope that people will, enjoy this great read. My dear friend Michelle Cox and I, she writes for the series When Calls the Heart. She and I co-wrote this book together, and it was a lot of fun to write this one.
Oh, that's great. Well, I can't wait to read it, and always appreciate your perspectives as always. Todd Starnes, thanks for covering this, and we need to be praying as an American Family Association family for the future of this country, for the safety of everyone here and also abroad, and for the West overall to understand and reclaim our founding in truth. We do have a Judeo-Christian heritage here in the United States and in Western culture, and we need to follow through on that rather than allowing a lot of these other false ideologies to come in, and then we see the effects and the damage of this. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
The month of June has been hijacked by the anti-Christian culture to show their pride in something God calls an abomination. When you support AFR, you help us continue to stand for godly values and provide the resources for you to stay in the know about the enemy's tactics. To say thank you for your gift this month, we'll give you the booklet, Inside the LGBTQ Push of the 1990s, to help strengthen your convictions. Just go to afr.net/offers. afr.net/offers.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And as we discussed in the previous segment, the Supreme Court handed Trump a win on revoking parole for 500,000 foreign nationals. And we want to do a little bit deeper dive into that and the whole argument around what to do with all of the illegals that are here in the United States. So that headline coming from Fox News. And of course, Justices Sotomayor and Justice Jackson criticized the decision as Trump moves to end protections for these illegals. And you can almost be assured that any time it's like Sotomayor and Jackson and, throw in Kagan once in a while, if they're in the dissent, the Supreme Court got it right. That's just, one of those obvious green flags. But what happened is the Supreme Court on Friday stayed a lower court order that blocked the Trump administration from deporting roughly 500,000 migrants and illegals from Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. The decision is a victory for President Trump as he moves to crack down on border security and immigration priorities in his second term. The order stays for now a lower court ruling that halted Trump's plan to terminate the TPS, or temporary protected status protections, for some illegals living in the U.S., which allows them to live and work in the U.S. legally if they cannot work quote-unquote safely in their home country due to a disaster, armed conflict, or other quote-unquote extraordinary and temporary conditions, temporary being the key word there. But let's welcome in Gerard Folletti, who's senior counsel for the Lawfare Project. And Gerard, this decision from the Supreme Court Friday, I think, comes at a interesting time as we were talking about the violent terror attack in Boulder, Colorado, yesterday from someone who is in the country illegally. And I think all of this is raising the broader question of immigration enforcement. But let's start first with the Supreme Court opinion. This is a good move.
It's a very good move, and it's a right one. What we're seeing is that the Trump administration, after perhaps getting off to a rough start, is doing deportations and immigration law the right way. There was notice to the people affected, which went a long way to, I think, convincing the Supreme Court that this is proper. And the Supreme Court is deferring to the administration on the enforcement of this law, as it should. What we really had was a program that was created by the Biden administration to allow 500,000 people to enter this country illegally, but nevertheless to enter with permission to stay. And that's something that is not contemplated for under U.S. law. So when Donald Trump canceled this program, he did so with the right mindset, meaning that we need to actually enforce the immigration laws that exist and make sure that people who are in this country have been properly vetted and are in this country properly. This program was not it. This was a temporary program, and Donald Trump had every right to end it. And that's what the Supreme Court essentially ratified.
Yeah, and this makes sense under our laws as written, and I'm glad to see that the Supreme Court understood that. And yet there remains this broader debate of somehow attaching not just due process, I think, in a broader sense, but also somehow some kind of right to people who have entered illegally to basically stay. And so the policy arguments in the court of public opinion, I think, are focused on the wrong issue here, Gerard. I mean, the issue should be if someone is here illegally, then they are subject to deportation, period. I mean, it's as simple as that. And we're seeing the effects of this this policy that, you know, the Democrats and the leftists would like to call humanitarian. But really, they're overlooking the fact that the government and the United States government specifically is obligated to preserve and protect the rights of Americans first.
Well, the issue, I think, is also how you define Americans, I think, and not to be cynical, but I think this is part of a long-term plan by the left that's been implemented for decades to change the fabric, the makeup of our country by intentionally allowing people to come into this country who might not share our values and who would not be here normally through the legal process. That's what these programs are. You bring in 500,000 people who should not be in this country. They didn't make it over the border illegally. They were brought to this country illegally. And at the end of the day, no matter how they're here, the left uses emotional arguments. They don't look at the law. They ignore the law. They make this emotional argument that applies to that is meant to apply to people's heartstrings, saying, okay, that people will accept the fact that these people are here and will stay even though they're not here legally. Now, when you actually start to look at the law and you see that there is no basis for this, then it creates a conflict because people's hearts want families to not be disrupted. But at the same time, that's not what the law says. These people should not have been brought here in the first place. So it's very tough. The Democrats have been very smart at crafting this because it's not a legal argument that they're using. It's an emotional one.
And yet somehow that emotional argument, you're absolutely right that it is emotional. It's not legal. And yet we've seen from the bench, even judges who are not vested with the power to, you know, follow their heart like a Disney, you know, romantic movie song or something, you know, just follow your heart wherever it leads. They are vested with following the law. There are still justices like Jackson and Sotomayor that even from the bench and a lot of these other lower court justices as well make these emotional arguments. And that becomes a huge problem when then emotion is injected into the law in a way that is fundamentally in conflict.
That's really the bigger problem, because we see this not just with immigration law, but we see this with pretty much everything else. You have judges, typically on the left, who make decisions based on emotion and not the law. That's why we have so many decisions that are not good. That's why we have that's why people are losing faith in the justice system, because there are judges who are ruling based on emotion and trying to justify that through legal arguments that normally would not hold weight. Even the Supreme Court's not immune to that. We see that with Sotomayor. We see that with Jackson. Once in a while, we see that with Kagan, too. But usually what the issue is that the law is fairly clear, but it's being misapplied by judges who want a different outcome.
And so when we're talking about the powers of the federal government and what Trump wants to do, I mean, it's pretty clear when it comes to immigration enforcement that the executive can enforce the law. So how is this even still a controversy in the sense of some of these justices and even some of the left that are going well outside of, you know, the bounds of the law, and they're just creating kind of this legal fiction to advance their own policy? But how can this even still be a debate when it comes to the Supreme Court?
I think it's still a debate because you have justices who unfortunately do have this preconceived notion of what outcome they want, and then they find the legal reasoning to support that outcome instead of looking to see where the cases are, what the precedent is, what the law actually says, what the intent of Congress is, what the powers of the executive are. There is still that base. They want an outcome to be a certain thing, and then they find the legal arguments. They construct a legal argument to justify what outcome they want. And Supreme Court justices are not immune to this. It's not the way we want the rule of law to be applied, but ultimately, that's what it is. And when you take something like due process, which most people don't understand to begin with, but you start using that as a leverage and including to that free speech, which has nothing to do with these deportations, which has nothing to do with the right of someone to be in this country to begin with, it just confuses the issue. And you start to have more and more judges across the country parroting that language, even though it makes no sense legally, and it will be overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. It's blocking these programs from being implemented. It's adding to the cost of removing these illegal aliens. It's making it so difficult that, you know, maybe they're hoping that maybe the Trump administration will just give up. And that's not happening. And that's a good thing.
And so then the conflict and the tension will persist and continue. But this Supreme Court decision is at least a temporary allowance for the Trump administration. Where is the legal argument going? I mean, are there cases that are coming up for the Supreme Court? I mean, we're ending kind of their term, at least for 2025, here in June, and then they'll take a break, resume in October. So where are we at in terms of the overall immigration battle and the structure right now in terms of the posture of the Supreme Court taking up any other potential immigration-related cases?
Well, I think that we have been seeing the Supreme Court showing deference to the administration. I think that the general message that the Supreme Court has been saying is so long as the administration is following the process that's laid out by Congress, that's laid out through the Administrative Procedures Act, then we will support what the executive does. That should be sending a message to lower courts. I don't think it has been, which means that when it reconvenes in October, or maybe even before then on an emergency basis, we will see the Supreme Court get involved in more immigration cases. Ultimately, we're also looking to see not with the organized programs from that come from the Biden era, but when we see attacks like the one in Boulder with immigrants who came from the Middle East on visas, when we see what's happening on college campuses, those cases have not been fully resolved either. So I think the Supreme Court will need to weigh in on those again. That's not on the immediate docket, but that may very well be on the so-called shadow docket, or it may emerge as some kind of an emergency hearing over the summer.
Yeah, and hopefully the Supreme Court will weigh in if there is a need for an emergency basis. And we'll just have to see with some of these outstanding issues. And we mentioned at the top of the program that this is June. This starts for, you know, some in the woke left, what they deem Pride Month. And the Supreme Court still has a few outstanding LGBTQ plus issues. And so, Gerard, before we go to break, I wanted to get your take on the couple of cases that are still outstanding. So as of today, the Supreme Court still has a few significant decisions pending for their 2025 term before that break for October. And these are, you know, a range of other critical issues, including immigration, as we've mentioned, religious freedom, healthcare, voting rights, you know, some of those things. But top four, specifically the protections of children and minors, and also parents who have the right to opt their children out of public school lessons that include LGBTQ themes, are the United States versus Scrimeti. This is the case that challenged the Tennessee and Kentucky laws that ban gender-affirming, quote-unquote, medical care for transgender minors. So the court will decide whether those bans violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And then also the case from Maryland that examined whether parents have the right to opt their children out of the public school lessons that include LGBTQ plus themes. So do you think that these two will be some of the last decisions that the court issues because they're so controversial? And where do you think that the court will land on these issues?
I think that you're absolutely right that these probably will be the very last decisions to come out this term, maybe even past the last listed date for the courts to issue opinions, as had been the case last year as well. And that's precisely because they're challenging cases and there will be a substantial number of Americans who are not going to like the outcome. Now, I think that with Scrimeti, that might be an unfortunate win for the proponents of gender change. I think that there have been arguments made that have been rather convincing about equal protection clause of the 14th Amendment applying. But ultimately, I think the Supreme Court has been more understanding of 14th Amendment arguments than others. So we may see that Tennessee bill actually fall. On the other hand, when it comes to parental rights to opt out, I think that there has been precedent, and that was made clear in the oral arguments, that the Supreme Court can follow to give parents that ability to opt out, especially if there are bona fide, strongly held religious beliefs that prevent the parents from wanting their children to be included in that kind of teaching at school. So I think it'll be a split decision on these cases, but I do think it'll be the last ones decided.
Yeah, I do too. And you're right. The Supreme Court has historically, even last term, gone beyond their last, at least publicly released opinion date. And you know, why is that? I mean, is it just that they're kind of waiting to say, okay, we fully packed up and we're going to head for the hills and then, you know, release this while, you know, Justice Gorsuch is back in Colorado, you know, camping and boating, and they just want to put it out there when they're not even in D.C.?
My sense is actually that these decisions are not made quickly, that the court is still considering the language of the opinions and the dissents and who is doing what in terms of writing them right up until the very end. So these are the complicated cases that they're actually giving more scrutiny to. I think that's why we see them taking so long. It's not that they're looking at the docket and saying, well, we want to be out of town when they're made public, but rather they're giving these cases the full attention that they deserve.
Well, that's a that's a better view of it than maybe my my skepticism of where the court lands on this. But but this also raises the question as well of the U.S. Senate right now, with a very, very slim and definitely not filibuster proof majority coming up with the midterms next year, and even the GOP Senate looking at the judicial nominees that President Trump has, and some of the track record of some of these senators. I'm thinking specifically in Texas of John Cornyn, and that primary coming up between him and Ken Paxton. Obviously, Trump hasn't weighed in with an endorsement, but Cornyn doesn't really have a great track record, even as a GOP member. And so, when we as conservatives are looking at the best person to vote for in primaries and also in elections in these states, this really does matter ultimately to the composition of the federal bench overall, not just President Trump's potential future Supreme Court appointees. I mean, everyone pays attention to the Supreme Court, but the federal bench is so incredibly important as well. And it seems like the GOP is not doing the best job when it comes to voting on federal judicial nominees.
No, it has not been. And I think that there was a missed opportunity with this last election, especially after we saw lawfare against Donald Trump for the last 4 years, for the Republican Party to drive home the message that who you vote for, especially in the Senate, has a direct bearing on the judges that you have on the federal bench. And look now, all these cases that we're seeing, the ones where judges are getting it wrong, that's the consequence of not having the right people sitting in the Senate chamber. I think the Republican Party would be smart, and I think they will be doing this, to emphasize the importance of voting in local and state elections as well for the same reason. You have state judges at issue. But ultimately, the Republicans need to do a better job putting people on the bench, because we even have Republican appointees who have disappointed significantly and gone the other way in interpreting the law. So this will be a very important issue. But beyond the courts, a lot of what Donald Trump is doing, there could very well be more done by Congress to help him. All of the actions that he's taking through executive order, he could have the support of Congress. Now, that's another reason for Republicans to make a strong get-out-the-vote argument. I think we will see that, and I think that we will see changes in who's sitting in the House and Senate.
Yeah, I hope so. And everyone, or at least a lot of people, a lot of the rhetoric online is how much Democrats have a messaging problem heading into 2026. They are kind of in disarray. They don't really have a key spokesperson, a key leader. Certainly Kamala Harris is not the head of the Democrat Party right now. But at the same time, Does the GOP also have a messaging problem, at least in translating to voters specifically why these judicial appointments matter and why their vote in a Senate race, for example, actually affects that? I mean, it seems like while there's some messaging on that, there is some failure to kind of make that conversion in the mind of voters, because we tend to see over and over, whether it's an incumbent or, you know, someone even new, the decisions that are made based solely on sometimes Trump's endorsement, which not all of those are, you know, at least in my personal opinion, the best. But we've seen, you know, a lot of these just kind of following whatever the messaging is instead of actually recognizing that we need to select the best person that will follow through on using their vote in the best way to protect freedom and liberty, which especially means federal appointments.
I think that the Republicans don't have a messaging problem so much as they have an occasional communicating that message problem. And I think you do point out something very accurate and astute, that some candidates are just not good candidates. They're not the right people to be delivering the message. And quite frankly, voters don't have they don't have that belief that those candidates will carry on with what they're saying that they're going to do. But overall, the idea that thing is sound, that the Republican Party is putting out a strong message about why it's important to elect the right people, but it's failing to communicate that message effectively when it comes to specific candidates. So when you're looking at the 40,000-foot view, when you're looking at conservative media, we all understand the importance of voting for the right person, but it's often lost when we have candidates who don't make that argument convincingly themselves.
So well said. And this is why we need to pay attention as voters in every election, know the issues, and know before election day or before you get your ballot. There's so many people that, you know, will contact me, for example, or will contact, you know, AFA Action and say, oh, here's my ballot. Who should I vote for? And they're kind of in a hurry and under pressure of the deadline. Make sure that you know well in advance. We do have the voting scorecard. We have a lot of resources from AFA Action as well. And there are a lot of different really great conservative groups, especially on the state level, that can provide detailed information on every single race, including if you're a state that elects your judges. All of these things matter, and we need to take the responsibility of self-government very seriously to participate in all of this. So Gerard Folletti, really appreciate it. You can follow him at Gerard Folletti on X. We'll be right back with more. This June 24th marks 3 years since Roe v. Wade was overturned. But here's what you may not know. Abortion numbers have surged to a 10-year high. The battleground has shifted from the courtroom to our homes. Today, over 60% of abortions happen through the abortion pill, taken in silence and often alone. Preborn Network clinics are standing in the gap, meeting women in their most desperate hour. And here's what they're seeing. Young mothers, terrified and misled, are delivering their babies, tiny, perfectly formed, onto bathroom floors. These precious babies, once called just tissue, now are lifeless. 11% of these women who take the abortion pill will suffer serious health complications. Countless others carry emotional scars for a lifetime. When you give to Preborn, you're not just saving a baby, you're saving a mother as well. You're giving her hope, financial support, and the truth. Preborn has already rescued over 350,000 babies, but there are so many more who need our help. Your tax-deductible gift makes this mission possible. To donate now, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And speaking of making sure that you are involved as a voter and you know what is going on in your state, Texas now, and I know we have a lot of listeners from the great state of Texas, Texas is taking aim at free speech. And this headline from The Blaze says, with a Republican trigger finger. And so this is HB 366, which threatens to criminalize humor and memes with jail time and vague rules about altered media. So Texas House Bill 366, now pending before the state Senate, targets quote-unquote digitally altered political ads. But according to this op-ed by my next guest, Chris Ekstrom, its vague wording and draconian penalties risk criminalizing satire, parody, and grassroots messaging, the very tools conservatives use to fight media bias and elite narratives. Texans must reject this betrayal of core constitutional principles. So let's welcome in Chris Ekstrom now, and he is a board member of U.S. Term Limits. And again, this great piece that you need to read is in The Blaze at theblaze.com. And Chris, this seems like a ridiculous thing that you would expect from, like, maybe New York or California, you know, one of the woke blue states, but Texas?
Good morning, Jenna. I love talking about Texas in the morning, and unfortunately how messed up it is. Texas is our cornerstone state, as you well know, for our presidential elections. It should be a place where we basically are being led from. But unfortunately, in our current situation, Florida is the place that's leading, and Governor DeSantis is the one who's been showing the way on how to get things done. Texas is almost in a state of breakdown, I would say, Jenna, and this ridiculous piece of legislation shows it. Last time I checked, the First Amendment was the same in Texas as it is in Florida or even California and New York. God bless you if you have the courage to try to exercise it from the right side in those states. But no, Texas is in sort of a meltdown, frankly, Jenna, and I hope there's a lot of good folks listening in the state of Texas, because what your last conversation was about low-info voters not getting involved in the primary. If Texas voters do not get involved in this next primary coming up and get rid of some of these absolute phonies and losers that have been reelected over and over again to their state legislature in particular, Texas could go blue.
And that's a really scary contemplation. And we did see, at least in the last 2024 election, really a rejection of a lot of the RINOs. I mean, there were quite a few. I mean, it was over a dozen that had supported the fake, ridiculous impeachment of Ken Paxton. And, you know, they were ousted in the primary. But there's more work to do, is what you're saying. And so where are the fault lines in the state of Texas right now? And what should voters who are listening currently from that state understand?
Well, the first thing voters from that state should do is not take Chris Ekstrom's word for it. And they should pull out that phone that has the Library of Alexandria level of knowledge in their pocket. And they should look up the Ken Paxton impeachment scenario. Essentially, the Attorney General of Texas, who is a Republican and a very conservative Republican, by no means a perfect man any more than I am or many other people are, but he was impeached by his own party, led by a faction of essentially RINOs and uniparty Republicans, and they failed to do it. But in the next iteration of a speaker's race, they elected a speaker using a majority of Democrats. So now you have a guy from the most red area, one of the most red areas of Texas, Lubbock, Texas, a guy named Dustin Burroughs, who is the speaker of the Texas House. And he got there because 45 Democrats and 35 or 36 Republicans put him there. So you have a de facto Democrat control of the Texas legislature right now. You don't have to look and forecast off into the future about what a blue Texas could be like. You basically have a rump party of uniparty or Democrats or whatever you want to call them. I like to call them Magic R Republicans. That R next to their name is supposed to be some kind of magic talisman where people just jump on board and say, oh, he's a Republican, I'm voting for him. And they've taken over. So none of the conservative priorities really got through in this last session, and Texas meets intermittently. It is not permanently in together meeting like many other legislatures in this country.
So you just have a truly absurd situation. And I'm going to go even further because I want to just tell the truth here today. Governor Abbott is completely poll-driven. He's never done anything without taking a poll. And sometimes, even when the polls indicate that people want him to do something, he does nothing. So he has not been a leader. Lieutenant Governor Patrick is moderately reliable. The Senate is the place where things like this ridiculous meme bill go to die, and probably and hopefully should die. I would be shocked if the meme bill is not killed there. But he's not really a leader either. He's been susceptible to ideas like red flag laws. So he's nothing to write home about. The only guy in Texas, and this is the sad and shocking situation, that bears any resemblance to a true leader who is tough and proactive and gets things done is Ken Paxton. And Ken Paxton has made the decision to primary John Cornyn without being immediately endorsed by President Trump. And God bless him, because that is a bit of courage shown in Texas, where most of the rest of the politicians are just absolutely useless and cheap, to be honest with you, Jenna.
Yeah, and you know, you are not by far the first person to come on this show and have that same candid view of what's going on in Texas. And you know, I know Ken Paxton well. He's a personal friend. You know, really strongly support everything that he's doing in Texas, and I think that that's clearly the reason that he was targeted with lawfare, with that fake, ridiculous impeachment, and thankfully survived that. But we're seeing kind of a mirror in Texas, what happened in my former home state of Colorado, which is, frankly, you know, why I moved to the free state of Florida. We're doing so much better work here, and it's much better to be a champion of a great team like Governor DeSantis's office than always just, you know, banging your head against the desk, because the Democrats, which include some Republicans, frankly, are not getting the job done. And all you're doing is having to shoot down some of these ridiculous things like Texas's HB 366. I mean, but similarly to Texas, Colorado had a one seat majority in the state Senate for Republicans up until 2018. And then that's when it went off the rails. And so even though Texas is controlled in theory by Republicans, it's still the same phenomenon where you have the Senate, at least, that will do the right thing. But if you lose control of the Senate, then Texas could not only turn blue in actuality, but even just in outcome. And that's what happened in Colorado. Yeah. So,
that's
go ahead.
That's right. Well, you know it, Jenna, and the Democrats actually came up with a blueprint using Colorado as their as their template for flipping states. And listen, this is I want to go further with Texas on this score. It is so absurd. Ted Cruz just whipped Colin Allred, who was a real poster boy for the Democrats. They thought he was going to pretend to be a moderate, and he was going to reach out, and, you know, he was a black candidate who was going to get sympathy for his life story, and he is a smart guy, and he is an accomplished guy. Ted Cruz whipped him. He beat him much better than he beat Beto, who I like to call Beta. He's one of my favorites. And Colin Allred was no pushover. He raised a fortune to run against Cruz. And frankly, Ted is somebody who can wear thin a little bit, let's face it. And he, you know, it wasn't clear what was going to happen. Well, we whipped him. Ted Cruz whipped Colin Allred and the Democratic Party in Texas. Then we got President Trump, who won also a popular vote majority in the country. The Democrats were at their lowest ebb. Here we go. The Uniparty steps in Austin. We like to call it the Austin sewer because it's actually worse than the D.C. swamp. At least in the swamp, you have some ecosystem and natural life. In the Austin sewer, there's nothing good that ever comes from there, apparently. The guys there get involved in a conspiracy, open conspiracy, with the Democrats, who are beaten down, totally hopeless, and they resurrect themselves into the party that basically says no to everything conservatives want to do in the state house. So this is exactly like you're talking about. Colorado was a state. Try to imagine Colorado giving up their guns. I mean, you're from there. I have an uncle who lives there. I just saw recently, and I said to him, how did they convince people in Colorado to essentially hand, you know, to some degree hand in the guns in one of the most western states? So it's not impossible. If we lose Texas, we lose the country, and we lose ever electing a president. And that's as simple as it is. And everybody, every Christian listening to this show right now, this ought to be, if you believe Chris Ekstrom and you believe Jen Ellis, this ought to be a wake-up call to you to understand our very red state of Texas is a big mess. There used to be an ad campaign, don't mess with Texas. Well, Texas is very messed up. I'm personally being sued by a state rep right now, and my case will go to court on Friday. He tried to intimidate me by messaging into his district, and he got the wrong guy. And I'm trying to lead the fight back for the grassroots, because what they're trying to do is silence all the Christians, silence all the Tea Party, ex-Tea Party, or whatever you want to call it, the new MAGA movement. And it isn't going to work.
And this is like HB 366. We got to leave it there, Chris Ekstrom. But I really appreciate it. If you're from the state of Texas, you got to get involved. You have to understand that we have to keep a conservative majority. As always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net. Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.